introducing me. Is this microphone working? Is the volume about right? Okay. And thanks for inviting me, is what I'm going to say. And I apologize for missing the student talks yesterday, because I really wanted to hear what the students had to say, but I had to pick up my wife at the airport after her flight was canceled the day before. All right, so I'm going to talk about combining the convex approach to information processing and foundations of physics with the categorical approach that, you know, Samson, Bob, Peter Selinger, and many others have been working with. So not everything I say is going to be on these slides. So let me just start out with some motivation. What many of us have been doing in this convex framework, of course, there are a lot of motivations there as well, but one strand, one maybe important strand, is to try to understand information processing abstractly in a way that might do several things. It may help us understand why quantum information processing seems to have additional power that classical information processing doesn't have, and what are the conceptual principles that underlie that additional power, or different aspects of that power, like the cryptographic, the fact that you can do key distribution and detect tampering with unconditional security, which you can't do classically. That may have a different conceptual source than the fact that you appear to be able to do certain kinds of computations faster than classically, at least as far as we know, like that. Or perhaps the Grover speed up in a query setting. So possibly by looking at both of these kinds of information processing in a broader framework that you know, includes classical and quantum, but also includes a huge variety of other stuff, we may not only understand the difference between classical and quantum better, but understand the nature of what's special about quantum information processing compared to other kinds we might imagine that might not you know, be realized in the physical world, but are nevertheless mathematically and conceptually interesting. And perhaps this might even help us with sort of obtaining a conceptual foundation for quantum theory that emphasizes the informational properties of the theory. Maybe, as I think has been mentioned before at this conference, that might be a good way to get a solid conceptual foundation and maybe make progress in, you know, integrating with other aspects of our physics, like gravitation, for instance, or at least in maybe making some progress with resolving conceptual puzzles like measurement problem, so that's motivation for a lot of the motivation for the work that I and my collaborators have been doing in the convex sets framework, and many other people have done in this historically, even since the 60s at least. I think it's closely related to Lucian's approach as well. So, you know, I think to some extent there are similar motivations for the categorical approach, and maybe other different motivations as well. So I'm going to now talk about why we might want to combine these approaches. So I think there are a number of reasons. One of them is, so my collaborator Alex Wills likes to say that you know, he thinks the categorical approach is more structurally rigid, but maybe ontologically more fluid. So in the convex sets approach, we have a definite idea about what we think the structures are. There are these convex sets, which are sets of measurement outcomes on the one hand, or sets of possible states on the other, for instance. Categorically, it may be less definite what, you know, except in a particular category, it may be less definite what the mathematical objects are you're working with, but typically you introduce some fairly strong structural properties, like certainly if you go all the way to dagger compact closure of a category, that's a very strong set of structural assumptions. So I think by combining convex and categorical approach, you can, for one thing, you can get concrete categories that may exhibit all or only some of structural properties like daggerness or compactness or closeness, and maybe see what happens in a very concrete setting when you, you know, throw things in or take things out or make up different principles, some of which will be ready-made already in category theory and some of which may be inspired by work in the convex set framework. And, you know, ask what kind of categories we get now or what kind of convex sets do these categorical assumptions lead us to. So I'm talking about working towards a framework where we can do that. And particularly I've been working a lot with Alex Wills on this, had some discussions over the years with Samson Bob and Ben Jackson in particular and other people in the Oxford group at various meetings. So this isn't all going to be finished work. This is sort of a look into work in progress and a project that's going on. So a rough overview of the convex operational formalism. So this is hockey stick. So we have, let's say we have systems, given names like A, B, C. Each system associated with a convex set of states, omega A, omega B, etc. This will just be, you know, for quantum systems, this is the convex set of density numbers. Okay, convex sets of measurement outcomes as well. And then a bilinear map from states on the one hand and outcomes on the other to probabilities. So I'll often refer to these measurement outcomes as effects because that's what people become used to calling them in quantum mechanics. And in quantum mechanics, they're just positive semi-definite operators, you know, between zero and the identity. That's an effect in quantum mechanics. Okay. And then maybe we also specify a convex set of allowable dynamics that takes states to states. So for each system, we specify that. And that convex set, I mean, obviously, it should be closed under composition. Just throw in the identity. In quantum mechanics, we take completely positive maps. So you can sort of see. Oh, and then maybe we want ways of making composite systems or of recognizing compositeness within a system that we could factor the system, if you like. And so we, in quantum mechanics, we have the tensor product of underlying vector spaces. And at the mixed state level, that's reflected in a tensor product space where the density matrices of these systems lie, which is also a tensor product of the underlying vector spaces where the density matrices lie. The individual system. So it's looking like we're moving towards a categorical structure here. And so we're going to take the basic idea that there are processes and that they have probabilities. The process has a probability, or rather specific processes that start in our unit object and end in our unit object have probability, and that the sets of processes are convex. And maybe states will actually correspond to preparation processes and outcomes or be processes that map back to probabilities once you have a state. So they map states to probabilities there, effects. Okay. I don't think I really need to spend much time on the definition of category here. I had sort of prepared this talk with the idea that not everybody would be incredibly conversant in categories. So I'll just run through this super quickly to maybe fix some notation. So a category's got a class, which I'm going to call, the category we call C, script C. Ob C is the objects of the category. These are like the systems in the convex approach. The set of morphisms from one object to another, sometimes called maps or arrows, I'm going to note C of A, B. It's a common notation, the name of the category, and the domain, and the codomain. So right in set, these are just the functions. Every object has an identity morphism. Okay, this composition, the identity behaves like you think it ought to. Right, examples. I don't think we need to go into examples a whole lot, except that I'll talk some about this category I'm calling FD ordered lin, which is finite dimensional ordered linear spaces and positive linear maps on those spaces. Just to quickly remind people, what's an ordered linear space? Well, it's a linear space or a vector space that's got an ordering on it, partial ordering, that plays nicely with the vector space structure. You can add inequalities, and they're still true. The resulting inequality is still
true if you have an inequality multiplied by a positive scalar. That's pretty much all that means. We're going to want, actually, when I talk about FD-ORD-LIN, I'm going to want a few extra properties that make them nicely ordered. So each ordered linear space has a positive code, right? And that is just the set of things in the space that are greater than equal to 0 in your order, right? So the set of x in the linear space that is greater than 0, that'll be called the positive cone. So if the space is A, the positive cone will be ordered A plus. Okay, so we're going to want that the cones, usually we're going to want that the cones are generating, they span the vector space. The positive cone minus itself is the vector space. Well, different ways of saying the same thing. So that's called positive generated ordered linear space. We'll also want the coin to be the cone to be pointed. And that actually follows from it being an order, because if it weren't pointed, it would just be a pre-order. Right, so you can go from a cone to an ordering, or if the cone is pointed, a pre-ordering, and vice versa. They're pretty much the same thing. All right. And in quantum mechanics, the relevant cone is just positive semi-definite matrices, right? And in classical mechanics, it's just Rn, well, not classical mechanics, classical probability theory with a discrete set of atomic outcomes, let's say Rn plus would be the relevant cone of unnormalized states. Okay. So going back to categories, when we think of our categories of convex operational models, that's like categories where the objects are different systems. So if we think about processes that we can do to go from one system or another. So the fact that we take, for instance, the dynamics and the state space to each of the convex sets, this instance is a general principle. And the idea is whatever can happen to a system or be done to a system can happen or be done conditioned on the outcome of a coin toss. By coin toss, I just don't mean some measure of objective probability. I just mean some event that the agent who's doing the operation ascribes a probability to. And in fact, we're going to argue that you can do this for an arbitrary probability. That's what gives you the convexity, right? Condition, let's say, a preparation process on some event that has an arbitrary probability. All right. And so if we implement this idea in categories where the processes are acting on convex operational models, we'll be saying that the Hom sets, the sets of morphisms, are convex. All right, so what's a convex operational model in more detail? I've sort of sketched this. I already defined a cone. Well, actually, I didn't define it, so here's the actual definition. Closed under addition and positive scalar. Regular cone is pointed, as we said, generating. Oh, and we'll also want the cone to be closed. And an equivalent condition should be imposed on the ordering. I think that I refer to FD, bidimensional ordered linear spaces. So they're nicely ordered, given away. In the dual cone A plus, I don't know if everyone's familiar with all these. I mean, I think a lot of people know these concepts, but I want to make sure everyone's on board. But it's a set of linear functionals from the vector space to the reals that are non-negative when applied to elements of the positive cone of this ordered linear space. So if you want probabilities that linearly depend on the state and that are positive, we're going to have to pick the functionals. We're going to have to determine them with functionals from this dual space. Okay, so a convex operational model, then, I will define as a triple, A sharp, and U sub A. A is a regular, pointed, generating, closed, ordered linear space. A sharp, well, as a vector space, it's just A dual, but then we order it by a cone that is a subcone of the dual cone, not necessarily the full dual cone. So operational models where you take the full dual cone are special, and they're particularly nice. You can think of them as having a Gleason-like property, which is sort of that, you know, every everything that's a logically possible measure that would give you, be linear and give you positive probabilities, is thrown in there as something that you concluded as something the operator can do. But you don't, you're not forced to do that when you're making up toy theories. Right? And certain toy theories don't have that property in fact. So if you, probably if you took, and I haven't fully worked out how you can specify Rob's theory, but it seems like if you tried to do that, it would not, it would not have the property of A sharp equals A star. A sharp plus equals A star. This would be a proper conclusion. UA is something we call the memory. It's just a distinguished element in the interior of A sharp. And that's sort of the trivial measurement outcome. It's the measurement outcome that gives you one when applied to every state. It's explicitly specified because we want to specify the normalized states, right? So this is the normalization function. It's just the trace and quantum case of the density matrix. And this is what picks out a base for our cone of states, A plus. Yes, Andreas?
Is it also all that you did in mathematical sense that for any two elements, there's this notion of...
You can get above any element by multiplying by an integer.
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
So if this ordering is Archimedean, it probably is. I don't want to guarantee it in general. That's not true. But yeah, it is what's intended to be what's called in order unit in mathematical sense. And probably I should have specified that the ordering should be Archimedean. I should think about that. Alright, so a non-Archimedean ordering would be like lexical ordering on R2, where you say anything with the first coordinate greater than the second coordinate is greater, and then if they're equal, you use the second coordinate to break the tie. That kind of ordering is also going to be a little bit problematic for this kind of theory problem. Okay, so now let's talk about categories made of these things. And I'll call these concrete categories of convex operational models. So an object is going to be a convex operational model, A, which is ordered linear space. So unfortunately, I'm going to overload these names of things. I'm going to use A. So sometimes A is the underlying vector space. Sometimes A is the ordered linear space. And A is also the object in the category. I will sometimes use the name A for the object in this category, which really refers to all of these things. Apologize for that. It should be clear what I'm referring to, and if things get confusing, please ask. They're very simple. This is actually a very simple stuff. Okay, so we just specify A sharp and the order unit, so we know what the normalized states are. Interesting aside, if you just take a positive cone here and you specify an order unit in its dual cone, you do get a different theory. You can get a different theory if you specify a different order unit. So it's not as if we could drop this and say, well, we can just introduce an arbitrary order unit and get the same theory. There are classes of cones, the homogeneous cones, in which that's true. Those are the ones in which every interior element is related by automorphism. So the dual is also homogeneous. An automorphism of the cone takes you from UA to any other order unit. That really doesn't matter which one you specify. But in broader classes of cones, it matters. So for instance, you take the cone with a square base, but you choose an order unit that slices it, so you get some funny structure like this, which is some kind of trapezoid, I guess. That theory will not be equivalent to the theory where you chose the base as a square. Because, for example, you can't distinguish these two faces by a single measurement. But if it's a square, you could. This is an affinely nice point. Okay, so we specify these things. That tells the object. What are the morphisms? Well, they are also regular cones of positive linear mass. And actually, they require them to be both positive on this A plus, positive on A, if you like, and also positive on A star ordered by this A sharp plus. So that means if we take an unnormalized state, plug it into our positive map, we get a state on the object B out, also unnormalized. That's positivity. And similarly, if we look at the adjoint map, and this is the adjoint as a linear map, you know, it's defined by the usual. So there's always a pairing, which is just applying a functional to a vector between the dual space and the primal space. And so the adjoint is just defined by, you know, phi of x, y equals phi, I think I'm calling it star here, of x. X, phi of y is phi star. That's what we mean by this adjoint. So we look at f star, and we look at it as a map. It's going to go from B star back to A star. It has to satisfy F star of B sharp is less than or equal to A sharp. So in other words, we look at the Heisenberg picture of this theory. That's essentially what this is, looking at the map. And the thing has to act positively there also. Right? This doesn't follow from the other thing. It would follow from the other thing if we had always taken the full dual cone as our effects. But since we're allowing the possibility of not doing that, we have to watch out that, you know, even though we operate positively on the primal cone, and therefore positively, the adjoint will operate positively on the full dual cone, it might take our chosen subset of the dual cone not to itself. And so we have to make sure that it does take it to itself if we want to have a consistent view. Well, so that's all that's going on here. We're making it into a category. We need composition identity. So they're just composition identity of linear maps.
Are you taking logisms to be all the maps that are of this nature?
No.
Don't you need to add the logisms as part of the specification of the operation model?
Yes, you do. Well, okay, so this is a matter of terminology, right?
Because I previously on the previous slide, you didn't include it.
So I did it about whether to do that or not. It's better, I would say, more sensible terminology for operational model would be to include the morphisms. That was sort of the kinematic part, if you like. I didn't include the morphisms. So the point is that for a given set of objects of state and effect spaces in this sense, of objects in this sense, you can introduce different morphisms. Different sets of morphisms between them. So I'm not defining a specific category that is determined by specifying all of these objects. I'm just defining what it is to be a concrete category of operational models and positive maps. And you can make many categories depending exactly on what you choose the morphisms to be. And there aren't just morphisms between, you know, A and itself, but we're also talking about morphisms from A, you know, objects A to other objects B. And it's, you know, it's sort of a delicate question how you want to interpret these things, because on the one hand, it seems like, you know, the morphisms on A are things you could actually do. They're processes, you build some stuff in the lab, and that makes it happen. And that is one interpretation of these categorical processes. But sometimes you want to think of morphisms, right? Sometimes you want to think of morphisms maybe just as a way of, like, focusing on some aspect of the system or some part of the system. So, for instance, in category theory, when you define subspace of a vector space, it's a case of the general construction of some object, you just want a monomorphism that goes into that object. And, you know, is that really a physical thing you can do? It's a useful thing to be able to do, to take an object and identify subobjects in this way. But it may not be that you can literally take this thing and physically turn it into this other object, which might be much more dimensional. So, you know, this is a mathematical structure, and we use it more or less in the same way that we use the category CPM in quantum information theory, although we don't always call it the category CPM. You know, we say, hey, there's a completely positive map from this space to this factor of it. We view it as a tensor product. This map is the partial trace map onto the factor, and so forth.
There's a very natural interpretation which forces you to have different types. Like, I've got one system A here, mm-hmm. and then I decide to compare a system B
yes.
to it, and then you automatically get non-matching types.
Yeah, but I mean, whether you can really make a system out of the void or out of a unit object is what you're really doing in that case. You know, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, maybe you just sort of brought something else into the realm of stuff that you're considering with your category. So
people sort of, you can have boxes, like you can put some coins into a machine and get a packet of chips out of it. So you can do it. So the machine,
like semiconductor chips?
No, sorry, I should say crisps, which is probably so.
There's apparently an iPod and like PlayStation or Xbox or something vending machine in the Toronto airport. So.
Right.
Yeah, I mean. There are different purposes to which you might want to put these categorical morphisms. That's all I'm really saying. In some sense, there's the world, and we're just picking stuff out of it anyway. So, I'll leave it at that for now. Okay, operational interpretation. I think I've gone over. So actually, use of A should define a base norm on A and an order unit norm on A sharp. So they're Banach spaces whose norms are bounded above by each other's dual norms, which is a way of saying that, you know, this kind of applies to the dual code. I already discussed the operational interpretation. Important thing is that the operationally meaningful morphisms are going to be those that are contracted with respect to the base norm, right? Because if they're not, that means they take some probabilities to be greater than one and work like that. As an aside for quantum information people, the base norm is a generalization of the quantum mechanical trace norm. And the cool thing about the trace norm is that it's the distance between two states in that norm gives the best probability of, you know, a constant of distinguishing those two states if you're presented them with equal prior probabilities, given the best measurement that you can use to distinguish them, the lowest error probability. So if you're far apart, this is the best. If this is zero, you can actually distinguish the perfect. And this, so this is true in these convex theories too. So nice property. We could actually try to make categories where instead of having this explicit order unit, we just we make all the structure categorical. So we just say only the operationally meaningful morphisms are morphisms. And so then objects are going to become pairs of base norm and order unit Banach spaces, satisfying the above conditions that we translate them in terms of norms. This you know, positivity and Heisenberg picture positivity. Right, and the morphism just are the norm contracted maps. I haven't thought as much about that way of doing it. It's the way I would prefer to do it if it really works out. But I think there might be more technical issues with it. So, okay. So something nice that we can do with these things, and maybe this is a step towards something we'd call an enriched category, is to put the convex structure entirely into the Hom sets. The Hom sets being these sets of morphisms, sets of positive maps we'll choose. And it's, you know, again, this is sort of not very deep, but the way we can do this is we equip the category of the unit object, which is going to be R ordered by R plus. And, you know, the unit sharp is going to be the same thing. Use of I is going to be that identity functional, the order unit on the unit object. And then we can look at states as preparation processes. So they're going to be morphisms in C, I, A. So they take you from just the real numbers to an object. And we can look at effects or measurement outcomes as processes in C, A, I. They take you from the object to the real numbers. And so it should be probabilities. And the point is really that you take a process that goes from like I to A back to I, this is some dynamics, and you prepare a state, you did some dynamics, you did a measurement, and this gives you a number. And so you have this category, and there's I there, and you just look at all these ways of getting from I back to I, and And those give you probabilities, all the processes in the theory. Okay, so a few extra comments. Obviously, so we're still going to require right, so if you start with this concrete category, you know, you have, this should be only A plus, and it should be A sharp plus. You have A plus around and A sharp plus around that you specified, you're going to want to require that, you know, these preparations and these measurement morphisms, you know, be isomorphic as components to A and A sharp. You know, or you can just dispense with explicitly specifying A and A sharp and specify them by specifying these, which is really the nicer way to do it. Okay, so we're going to require that the Hom sets be regular cones of linear maps. And you might also try to do this in this Banach-based setting where you only allow contractive maps. Okay, and so I think I've sort of mentioned you can dispense in this way with the explicit structure of that object. So you just, that's like state space here, defect space there, and these things like A and B themselves are just more or less labels. Okay, and then these requirements, things like phi, you know, phi star, B sharp, so this Heisenberg positivity, they become automatic just from the definition of category. And the requirement that Hom sets be convex cones, or convex sets of contractive maps. I mean, requirements like this are inspired by the idea that probabilities should be positive. And if we calculate all probabilities as, you know, the probabilities of processes that begin and end in the unit object and require them to be positive maps, that says, you know, that be a positive map. That's saying the probabilities are positive. So the notion of a category is going to do any kind of bookkeeping we might need to worry about as far as, oh, we threw together all these different sets of positive maps, but could we somehow get something bad out of that? You know, like you do in quantum mechanics, for example, if you want to have a certain tensor product, you know, you say, oh, can I throw in this positive map on a factor? Well, it's entangled state? No, not necessarily. Okay. So I think I might speed up a bit. I think all this stuff can be formalized in terms of a category enriched over the category ordered linear spaces. So let's just be informal. I decided to be informal. A category enriched over some other category V is a category whose Hom sets, whose sets of morphisms, all have some additional structure in a systematic, nice way. They're all objects of this category V. And so the systematic way of doing this is, all right, so make this, you need V to be what's called a closed category. And so what we're proposing to do is take this category FD or Lin. We want all our Hom sets to be sets of positive maps on ordered linear spaces. Okay, I think I will not go into the definition of closed categories. There's one that does not require that it be monoidal. There's another that's requiring that it be monoidal. These are the kind of categories you can enrich over. So the main point is just that this FD or Lin can be made monoidal closed. And I've been thinking about it this other way without the monoidal structure. But, so with tensor, the minimal tensor product.
Sorry, Greg.
Yeah.
I thought you enrich over a monoidal category. Where do you need to be closed?
Well, this is called, you can, since FD or Lin is a monoidal closed category, you can enrich over it. You're saying you could also enrich over just a monoidal category?
In general, the way you enrich is over a monoidal category.
You don't think it's required to be closed?
No.
Okay, well that's...
You do need monoidal though, because you need to say what composition is.
So. Okay, so I was going to more or less say the opposite, which is that there is this notion of closed categories that doesn't require them to be monoidal, although you can always embed these in a monoidal category, and that you can enrich over those. You don't think so, okay. Well, so there's a 65 article by Eilenberg and Kelly that I've been thinking.
But you can actually enrich over, I'm not sure.
Yes.
All you need to have is
because from this you can get a map from A AB bracket, BC bracket, yes. AC bracket. Mm-hmm. You can then do, mimic the same thing.
Yes, so you need to be able to say what a map from A tends to B to C is, or if you wish, the map from A to B.
You can do this on the Kelly tour de force where with just a unit object and the internal hog, you can encode mm-hmm. everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I've been looking into that, and I think you guys have convinced me that it's more complicated than you need to do. But I think they're very close to the same thing, the modal flows. Certainly, you can embed any closed category in a monoidal category. I just haven't looked at the embedding just to see, you know, how nice it is.
Well, closed is a stronger requirement. You only want to...
Well, then we should talk about... I mean, in any case, this thing is closed, monoidal and closed, but we should maybe talk about it. This is a...
Oh, it's pretty good. Minimal principle. Doesn't that drastically reduce the like maps in general home? Just basically... projectives.
I don't think so. I mean, if you have the minimal tensor product, so just thinking of a category where the minimal tensor product is actually your state space, you can take all positive maps as your morphisms, if you want.
So the points of the minimal tensor product are not just the separable states.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is be positive on that.
Okay.
Anyway, maybe we should talk about it.
Yes,
but I think that's the way to do it. Okay. So I haven't worked out all the details of actually formally doing this as an enriched category over finite dimensional linear spaces, but I think that is the right way to do it. Okay. So let's say we have one of these categories of convex operational models. I'm going to define a notion of a saturated object, which is just what we talked about before. A sharp is the full bullet. You've thrown in all of the measurement outcomes you possibly could and still have the kind of theory you want to have. So classical theory and quantum theory are locally saturated. So I'm calling it locally saturated if all the objects are saturated. I think we've discussed this already. So now another definition. Let's call a category saturated if there's no way to extend the category by adding positive maps to some onset. So now it's not just only the state and effect spaces we're concerned with, but no way to extend it by adding positive maps to any of the offsets. And you might think these would be sort of the nicest categories of this type and would have special properties maybe easier to work with. Yeah, another thing that we defined along the way is, let's say it's locally Hom saturated at A and B, with the subcategory whose objects are just A and B, and the identity. So, you know, you've got things, states going here, effects going there, various morphisms going that way. So that subcategory is actually saturated. So that basically means you've thrown in all of the positive maps that you can, all the positive maps that you can, given the state and the dual, the state and vector spaces you've chosen for these things. Quantum theory is locally saturated, of course, because the positive semiconductor becomes self-dual. But it's neither locally Hom saturated nor saturated. Okay, so you just consider two quantum systems, or maybe two copies of the same system. You know, there are positive maps that you don't that are not completely positive, but that would be perfectly okay if you didn't have any other stuff around that you could tensor it with. Okay, and this is a little tricky. It's not actually saturated if you ignore the monoidal structure. And we'll see why that is in a second. So I'll quickly cover compositeness in the convex approach. So BBLW's John Barrett, me, Matt Liefer, Alex Wills. We've done quite a bit of work on this. There's a paper on teleportation, on quantum pH. There's one on, or two on broadcasting and plumbing, actually. One of which is in Israel Letters, the short version. The long version is just a few things. And then John Baer has a really nice paper in BizRev A that I urge you to read that doesn't necessarily use this terminology against product, but it developed a lot of some ideas and it's based on this work as well. Okay, so how do we define a composite system? We're going to call this a tensor product. Just say it's a state space, A tensor B. It's ordered by some cone. So it is the vector space, the tensor product of the vector spaces where the states lie, ordered by some positive cone that is required to contain all product states. And then A sharp of A tensor B, the positive cone of the composite effect space, is required to contain all product effects. And the order unit is just the obvious thing, the product order. Okay, so this implies, this implies certain properties. No signaling, so we have well-defined marginals. If you do something over here, for instance, you do an operation that preserves probabilities. So it's not properly contracted in the norm, then you can't change the marginal on the other side. You can't change any probabilities of what happens on the other factor. And local observability, which means basically expectations of products of local observables determine states. And that just falls on the fact that we took this B, the tensor product vector space here, of the vector spaces of each system. We don't have any extra dimensions that pop out when we take a composite. Okay, so this doesn't determine a tensor product. It doesn't determine a tensor B plus, unless one of them is classical. But it just gives some desiderata that you might want to impose. Local observability actually, clearly it seems like something that has content. Whether you want to impose it or not might depend on what kind of theory you want to cook up. Okay, examples, you take all states positive on product effects, that's the maximal tensor product. Only the convex combination of the product states, that's the minimal tensor product. The quantum mechanical tensor product is properly between the maximal and the minimal. Okay. So in categories, you would want to use a monoidal product to give you a composite. Okay, so this is just... So you can equip a category with a monoidal product by choosing a bifunctor from the product category to the category. The product category is just this very simple thing where you take pairs of objects as objects, pairs of morphisms as morphisms, and you just compose component-wise, and the identity is the obvious thing. And right, so if you have a categorically defined monoidal product, it is going to impose that the state space, C of X, A and B, contains all product states, the effect space contains all product effects. And these are two of the requirements we had on the previous page. But it's not going to impose local observability. And just as a side note, it looked to me like the condition at the end of Daniel Lehman's talk was very similar to local observability, right? Because you had morphisms out of something being out of a product thing being determined by what they did on product morphisms going in. So it seemed related. Okay. So I think I'll end pretty soon with some motivations for why we might.
5 minutes later. Excuse
me. So
5 minutes.
Okay. So I have a few more minutes. Motivations for why you might want, why you might think it's okay to drop local observability. Well, one, category theory doesn't force it on you, so why would we accept anything that's not forced on us by category theory? Okay, categories you were out, sir. But there is a little lyric on the net that you could sing to the tune.
California
Okay, so it could be motivated by a desire to preserve some other property. like, for instance, self-duality of your cones. I haven't defined that. Quantum mechanics has it. Classical probability has it. So an example of that would be, you know, we can have a monoidal category of mixed state spaces of finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And this, I think, is something Peter Sellinger and I discussed on a bus at Harvard Urgel for a little while. Which doesn't, so if I say something wrong, that doesn't mean it's his fault. okay, so positive semi-definite matrices over the product, tensor product of two real Hilbert spaces, there's no tensor product underlying Hilbert spaces, span a larger space than the tensors of the positive semi-definite matrices over H1 and positive semi-definite matrices over H2. Interesting fact. This is not true, but this is complex Hilbert space, they span the same space. But we could, if we wanted, let you know our categorical product of the mixed state spaces be all of the positive semi-definite matrices on the product of the underlying Hilbert spaces. And thereby we would get some extra dimensions popping out when we take a composite. What those are good for in the case of real quantum mechanics, I don't really know whether they'll do any weird information theoretic stuff. But in general, the idea of allowing, of not requiring local observability does allow you to do weird information theoretic stuff. And so an example is something I cooked up in thinking about bit commitment. So as part of this project, you know, we like to think about, you know, what are all these different information processing capacities? How can we combine them? Can they be very arbitrarily? Do some things always imply other things and so forth? And so key distribution is one, bit commitment is another people often think about because you can't do bit commitment either in quantum mechanics. So what's bit commitment? You want a functionality basically that just lets Alice put a bit in a box, send it to Bob. Bob knows Alice can't mess with it, or at least he can do a check that assures him that she hasn't messed with it. But Bob can't actually find out what it is until Alice does some other thing and says, okay, I now reveal this bit to you. It's a very powerful primitive in cryptographic settings. And as far as you know, won't do it except with the computational complexity assumptions enforcing the hidingness. But so John Smolin pointed out that, well, we could just have physical theory, couldn't we, where we just said, well, there are systems that are lockboxes that function like that. You have one, you stick a bit in it, you send it to somebody, and then there's some other thing associated with it you can send that will open it up. Now, you need a key. Yeah, I don't think I'll go into what this Hexaity objection was. His schemes required these things to have unique serial numbers on the key, and on the blocks, so you know that they matched up. But you can actually do this, I think, in the convex framework with no unique serial numbers, which I guess Bob and Halverson were saying is Hexaity. It's like the idea that objects have an essence that is only theirs, not determined by the properties or something like that. We can set up a theory in which we have, an object that just, its state spaces, let's say, R plus. If you don't tensor it with anything, but when you tensor it with something, its state space is a bit. So we have another dimension that's coming in, and that extra dimension can be used to encode a bit when you have two of these systems. And then you send one to Bob, and now nobody can mess with this bit. You set up the morphism so that you can't mess with the bit unless you have both systems. You can also put up a variant where you can flip the bit even though you only have one system. And so using this, you can do bit commitment. You can formalize Smolin's lockboxes, but you've got to go away from this local observability requirement. So I guess since Bob is standing up, that's a good place to end. It was a good place to end anyway, because I've just given you several motivations for not accepting limitations on compositeness that are not imposed on us by category. Okay.
Questions, comments?
So, given that you have sort of a lot of results in the setting of convex operational models about, as you were mentioning, about sort of no broadcasting and teleportation and so on, I mean, how might these look at this categorical setting? I mean, would there be some new new elements coming in, or?
So I think it's a good thing to do is try to translate them into the categorical setting. And I think a lot of them are going to look related to results that there are in the categorical setting. So for instance, the teleportation results, we had some sufficient conditions for conclusive teleportation, which means you can't necessarily do it with unit probability, but at least there is a measurement outcome. So it's again, it's a three-system setup where you have A, tensor B, tensor C, and first Alice, is this right? Yeah, so something's coming in here and you want to teleport it. Alice makes some measurement here, sends B to Bob. Bob has, first B and C are prepared in some state, which may be entangled, would be the Bell state. Then Alice makes a measurement here. They initially share this entangled state, but she sends B to Bob, and then Bob maybe does something here, but the state should come out there. And so it turned out that the necessary and sufficient conditions involved having a certain entangled measurement outcome here and certain types of entangled.
So she's sending a qubit
here. Well, no, this is a convex system, right? So this is an abstract framework. So we want to translate a state of one of these abstract systems over here by the abstract analog of a teleportation protocol. It would be a qubit in the quantum case, but in general, it's just one of these.
So why not just swap them and send A and then ignore C?
Swap them and, because we are only supposed to use pre-existing entangled states and not actual,
So is she sending classical information to Bob, or?
Yeah. This,
okay.
Yeah, but this may be messed up. You only want to sending classical information to Bob. So you want B tensor C, and there's nothing gets sent except in the preparation stage. So Alice has this stuff. They've prepared an entangled state. She makes a measurement here, and she sends the outcome to Bob.
Okay.
Bob does something. Yeah, sorry about that. So it comes out very similar, except that considering situations where maybe there wasn't a monoidal product here, but we just had some big tripartite composite and found conditions there. The thing is the AB state space and the BC state space, if they're not isomorphic, then, for instance, if you have the minimal tensor product here and the maximal tensor product there, you can still do it because the minimal tensor product has the entangled outcome and it's dual, and the maximal tensor product has the entangled measurement. Sorry, the entangled state in it. So you need the state here and measurement there. Anyway, so I think there are close relations. It would be fun to explore them more. I guess I'm kind of more interested in trying to tease apart all the different assumptions you might make and look individually at what do they imply in the convex sets framework and how does that help us understand things like compactness or for instance, the dagger that I just started thinking about, and so forth.
Okay, thanks for speaking again.